Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Three Down Nation podcast. The boys are back together and we got a facelift. No, we didn't need Botox or any fillers like that, fellas. A fresh logo. And if I might say, a fresh looking website, man, it looks so clean, clean. I love it. Shout out to the people who helped us with that. You two were obviously involved and the crew with Harvard Media as well. And Greg from the Piffles podcast, we should be public about this, I think, because he does great work, really helped us out with the logo. Shout out to Hodge for making that connection. I love everything about it, guys. And I don't know about you, but I find myself like just wanting to be on the website more now that there's this fresh new look. What say you?
I don't know that I could possibly be on the website any more than I already am.
Yeah, that's probably true. But I do like looking at the website and not from a technical standpoint, feeling a little bit embarrassed. Like it's so nice. Like I've always been very proud of our content, don't get me wrong, but it's nice to look at the website and be like, man, this website would have looked so slick in 2013. Like it's so nice to be like, boom, this is a 2026 fresh, clean and super like quick responsive website. It's such a pleasure to use. I know we still get feedback sometimes about ads and yes, we are working on that, but the logo, the format, the layout, the speed is exceptional, and we're so thrilled to be able to bring that to our wonderful listeners, our readers, our viewers, all of our wonderful people who support us in our endeavor.
I think we do want to hear feedback. Let's make it very clear. JC, you go ahead.
Feedback is good.
I was going to say, I think the site is fantastic. I think the logo is crisp, but my real question is there any money in the budget for a facelift for the contributors? Because myself, I don't know. I'm aging like milk left out in the sun on a hot summer's day.
You're aging like cheese.
Exactly. I'm aging like cheese, but not good high quality cheese, like backyard barn cheese, not the type you want to eat. So if we've got any money to like fix this up, maybe make me a supermodel, that would be great.
JC, don't cost money to get down and do some push-ups and air squats and sit-ups, bro. I've been telling you this for years. It would fix your breathing problems, all the rest.
What is an air squat?
Just squatting with like no weight, essentially.
Oh, I see. Okay. That makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah, get that bum down past 90 though, Hodge.
Don't be cheating. Hey, my bum gets down, boy. My bum gets down. I'll tell you that.
In all seriousness though, we do want to hear feedback from our passionate readers of the website, obviously the listeners and viewers as well. Anyone that's consuming our content in any way, we do want to hear that feedback. I will say from the standpoint of the logo and the look of the website, the feedback has been overwhelmingly positive. There has been some people that wrote in specifically to our email address and just said straight up, I hate your website. And it's like, well, that's not really constructive. We can't help our website be better if you don't provide some constructive feedback. So feel free to do so. We want to hear it. We want to make the website, the podcast, and everything else the best experience that we can for our loyal followers. So do not hesitate to send us a note on social media, to email us, what have you, to reply to the newsletter that got a new fresh facelift as well. Shout out Neil at Harvard Media for doing a lot of work on that. And Sully for the overall technical work on the website as well. He's absolutely crushing it. So we are trying to balance the user experience with obviously being able to bring in money so that the site can be around in the long term. I think we should be public about that. So we do want to hear the feedback and we are working. Little tweaks like Sully added an around the league feature. So on the homepage now, it's more easily visible on desktop, but even on mobile, where the bulk of our traffic comes from, you can see the latest couple stories with respect to every single team in the Canadian Football League right on the homepage. So we're trying to make it accessible and easy for you to navigate the website. So if you have an issue, don't hesitate to hit us up. I'd rather you not swear, but if you're passionate, I suppose that's okay, and we'll try to change as best we can. We ready to go, boys?
fired up and ready to go. It's been like 3.5 weeks since all three of us sat down and actually talked about the news. We've done a few combine-focused podcasts, but there's a lot to get into. Let's get into the meat of it.
Look at JC going off the cuff, man. I love
fired
it.
Up.
Coming along so well. So let's get to it. We're discussing the Edmonton Elks' quest for profitability.
Chris Streveler hanging up his fur coat for good.
Work visa issues for a Canadian quarterback. Imagine that, guys.
Rick Campbell returning to his father's team.
Stadium rumors in Calgary.
And which CFL team has the best quarterback room? But first,
BC Lions quarterback Nathan Rourke has officially put his name in the mix to be Canada's flag football quarterback at the 2028 Los Angeles Olympic Games and has decided to suit up for an adult recreational league as prep. The Lions are on board with the decision as the franchise does not believe there is an injury risk, while national team head coach Paul Appelese praised the move. Is this a smart idea for Rourke, and does it help the CFL?
I think when you're talking about smart idea here, there are a couple of different ways that you can look at it. From a Olympian perspective, if Nathan Rourke wants to be the quarterback of Team Canada if they qualify for these games, I think this helps him a lot. Not that he's going to get the stiffest competition in the world in the British Columbia Adult Flag Football League. These are people who have regular jobs, lead ordinary lives, and are coming together on the weekends to play some recreational flag football. He is clearly head and shoulders above the rest in terms of his athletic ability. But in terms of understanding the game, seeing the field, you know, knowing the dimensions and the timing of everything, I think this is going to be very helpful for him. And he's playing with some pretty good players. He's practicing with them for the Van City Vice, guys who are in the mix for the national team right now. All of that is going to show his commitment level and get him tuned up and ready in 2 years' time. Now, I do have some reservations as to whether it is smart for a professional quarterback of his caliber to be absorbing any risk whatsoever by doing a recreational activity like this. And let's be clear, this isn't tackle football. People aren't out there trying to hit Nathan Rourke. Not that I'm sure many of them would be able to if they tried. But any time that you compete to any degree, you are observing risk. I think back to Robert Edwards in the early 2000s, who tore up his knee playing flag football at a Pro Bowl, and it basically ended his NFL career. He was able to revive it a number of years later in the CFL, but that had a devastating impact in what was a recreational fun activity at a fun event. And for Nathan Rourke, any number of things could happen. He could step wrong and twist a knee. Somebody could come in to try and bat a pass, and he could bring his hand down, making a throw, and split it open, right? There are inherent risks here. There are inherent risks with training as well, but you are taking on a little bit more. I'm not sure if I was the BC Lions that I would be comfortable with the optics of this and with the added risk. But then again, there is no person who matters more to that organization than Nathan Rourke, and that goes both ways. If he wants to do this and he's serious about the Olympics, he'll play flag wherever he wants to, because that's the level of pull that he has in this organization.
There is injury risk, but I think it's low. And the upside here for Nathan Rourke, the BC Lions, and the CFL is absolutely massive. If Nathan Rourke is going out and throwing dimes over potential NFL defensive backs in the Olympics, I think it's really going to open up even more eyeballs. And we already know this, the talent in the CFL is arguably right there with the NFL. We see guys all the time go from the CFL, get opportunities in the NFL, and then to varying degrees have success. Probably the latest, most notable one would be Alex Singleton. You know, D. Alford is another one. There have been a bunch of examples over the years. So I think that having Nathan Rourke potentially playing for Team Canada, and I say potentially because he's still got to earn the spot and Canada still needs to qualify, I think both of those are highly likely, but there is possible competition for Rourke at the quarterback position. Curtis Rourke has been talked about. Trey Ford would be intriguing. But when you look at the flag football rules with the quarterback not running, I think Nathan Rourke makes a lot of sense. We know about his running ability, but if you want to keep his risk down, and then you have a guy like Trey Ford who is much faster than Nathan Rourke, be your second quarterback and be able to do some of the, I'll call them gadget plays that Paul Appelese has talked about, or two quarterback plays in the flag game, I think that would be very intriguing. Michael O'Connor is currently the Canadian quarterback for the flag football team that will go to Germany in August. I believe it's from the 13th to the 15th in Dusseldorf. And from what him and Anthony Eau Claire told me in exclusive interviews, Canada needs to qualify in the top two to get to the Olympics. There is another way that they could get in a tournament later leading up to the Olympics, but they're focused on qualifying so that you can prepare. And I think that would help Team Canada from an overall perspective. If you qualify, then you can go to these players in the CFL and the NFL and say, okay, we already know that we're in. Who's interested? And you go through your talent ID process and selection for the team at that point. So I think there's a lot of upside here. Is there risk? Yes. But what stood out to me is that Nathan Rourke actually told Three Down Nation that the BC Lions called him first about this. So they are being upfront, supporting him in this endeavor, even though there is a risk. And I think Nathan Rourke also spoke about this with us as well in a one-on-one conversation that you can find on our YouTube channel or the audio podcast. And there's a great article that JC wrote off of it, that he feels like playing flag football can help him in the tackle football game. Mm. So I get it. There is some risk here. The BC Lions are the team, arguably, that are going to have the most risk of a potential CFL player going to the Olympics and possibly missing games. That was the other thing Rourke added, is that the CFL is apparently talking about the possibility of having at least one bye week in that rough 3-week period around the Olympics for the players who are going to the Olympics, or for the teams that have players that are possibly going to the Olympics to play flag football. So I think there's a lot of positive here all around. And I like that Nathan Rourke's going after it. He wants to win a gold medal. He talked about the possibility of his jersey even right now, JC, that was an extra one, and he just wanted a proper sized one. Happened to be money bags with a money sign on it. But it's kind of like roller derby, where you get a nickname, and he joked about it potentially being Kid Canada on the actual jersey that the team would get for him. So we'll see if that comes to fruition, but I think that nickname would be fitting, and it's great to see him going after it. It's absolutely rare to get the opportunity to compete in an Olympic Games. And for a professional athlete in football, we all know those careers are so short. So there's no telling that if flag football would be in the games 4 years after Los Angeles, that some of these guys would even be at their peak to be able to make that team. So I like that he's getting after it.
Question: when players finish the season, do they just sit on the couch for 7 months until the next season starts? Or do they?
Not like you, Hodge.
Yeah, I know. Or do they train? Like, I'm pretty sure every quarterback in the CFL right now is in some way, shape, or form on a grass field practicing their throws and their rollouts. So, like, yes, there's injury risk here. That is an undeniable fact. But I feel like a lot of these activities are ones that every quarterback does all the time, right? Training is not without risk. Every year there's at least one player around the league where around this time it's like,
look at Davis Alexander last year.
Exactly.
The hamstring, right? In the offseason in terms of training.
Exactly. There's always one player where the rumor mill starts to swirl, like, oh, this guy's retiring, or like, oh, this guy tore his Achilles last year or last week and nobody knows yet, right? Every year it happens to a couple of guys. It's rare, but it happens every year pretty much. So the injury concern here does not really matter to me. This is not a contact game. These are essentially the same things that Nathan Rourke, and I'm far be it for me to pretend that I'm some type of expert on offseason quarterback training. There's a million people who could speak to that better to me. But my point is, it's not like if Nathan was not playing flag football, there would be no injury risk for him going into 2026. Players are always training on field, off field, in the gym, whatever. that does not bother me. So I think this is a cool opportunity for Rourke. I think it's a cool opportunity for the other flag football players. Imagine rolling into the office on Monday and being like, hey, I guess who the quarterback is on my flag football team. Let's go. It's the CFL MOP. That's pretty cool. So I like this. The injury risk does not really factor in for me.
I think it'll be intriguing to see if other CFL players who are hopeful to make the Olympic team follow suit in different capacities and try their hand at some recreational flag in the near future, because Paul Appelbaum was pretty clear when speaking to the media before the CFL Combine that, hey, we're not just handing out jobs here to CFL players. This is going to be highly competitive. We know that NFL players will be in the mix. We know that flag players who are currently on the team and who have that very specific tailored skill set will also be invited to that ID camp and have a chance to potentially make the Olympic roster. There's going to be a ton of competition. And he said point blank that anyone who wants to make this team is going to have to commit to a flag specific training program and show that they are committed to balancing that with their current CFL activities. So will we see more players go out onto a flag football field and play with recreational leagues? I know there's a great one in Montreal. Will Tyson Philpott be out there anytime soon playing with those teams to tune himself up? I think the quarterback position is a little bit different because of the dynamics that you need to be adjusted to, which is why Rourke's doing this. But I think it's entirely possible that we could see more CFL players try their hands at this potentially next offseason as we get closer to the Olympics. And what that makes me ask, and I'm interested to hear your guys' opinion on this, is optically, is that a plus or a negative for the Canadian Football League? Because I think you can argue it both ways. Obviously, if Team Canada qualifies and there's a couple of CFL players on that team and they win an Olympic medal, that is huge for the CFL. That boosts the profile, that adds attention. But in the lead up to it, is having your MOP out there on a recreational flag football field good for the league's marketing? Is it showing how accessible CFL players are, and that's part of what makes this league so special as we know? Or does it add to the perception that they're not at the same caliber as NFL athletes and they're just average Joes, which there's a lot of critics out there and detractors who wrongly peg that on the CFL? Is it a negative to have your players out there competing with average people who are playing this game for fun? Personally, I think it's on the cooler side, but we certainly wouldn't see Josh Allen or Patrick Mahomes or Lamar Jackson out there against accountants and business managers and used car salesmen on the weekends in the NFL. That's just not a dynamic that top-tier professional leagues tend to have. So it's a unique situation, and I wonder where you guys fall on that spectrum.
I don't know if we can say that with certainty, because a competition like you're talking about potentially for the U.S. team quarterback spot is going to be heavy, and they're going to have to decide that playing flag football, as that Fanatics event showed, where Team USA beat some current NFLers and former NFLers. I think this game is totally different. Michael O'Connor was explaining it to me. Nathan Rourke was as well. Anthony O'Clair, who's a former NFLer that's currently on Team Canada, was talking how it's a skill game. You can't even make any contact with the receiver prior to him catching the football. In fact, there's like no contact at all in this game. You know, there might be a little bit. Anthony O'Clair was kind of comparing it to basketball, but you can't even really play through the receiver as a defensive back. You can barely breathe on them, is essentially what they were explaining to me. So I think this is all upside for the Canadian Football League. And the fact that Rourke is going out and getting these reps, I think is going to only help him. I don't see how it hurts. Hodge is right. His point was bang on. Guys get hurt in training all the time. For Rourke, he described it like he's out doing a throwing session, essentially, because he's not running as a quarterback there. So he's working on his throws in these windows. Is there risk? Yes, but I don't see it as a negative. And when you look at, like you said, the American guys, there's going to have to be a way where they decide who's the quarterback for Team USA in a flag football setting, somehow, some way. Are they going to go out and compete in a recreational league? You know, it would be hard to see, but I think it's smart what Nathan Rourke is doing. The more reps you have, the better you're going to be.
I agree. I think there's times, right, where anything that paints you is like amateur, right? Or anything that seems amateurish is bad optics for the CFL. Like, I remember years and years ago, this would be around when John Cornish won his MOP. So this is like 2013, right? And an American news outlet wrote about how he works at the bank in the off season. Like, that was terrible optics for the CFL, because the assumption is, oh, this is a guy who, you know, he's the best player in the league, but he doesn't even make enough money to live off of. He's working at the bank. And it's like, well, no. He makes enough money to live off of. He's planning for his career after football. This is not a necessity. This is just smart planning, because, yeah, training is important in the off season, but it's not a 40-hour a week job. So why not prepare yourself for life after football? And by all accounts, John Cornish is doing very well for himself in life after football. So if this was the type of thing where Nathan Rourke was playing semi-professional football for $250 a game, yes, bad optics. If he's just out there learning a new sport that is about to be an Olympic sport, to me, that's not bad optics. And yeah, like, haters are going to hate, and that's fine. I don't think anything can change someone's mind if they've just decided that the CFL is trash or the CFL is Bush League, and that's fine. They're entitled to their opinion. But I don't think this should be viewed as a negative from any reasonable person who hasn't already made up their mind. That's my take.
Let's keep it moving. Hodge, you recently went one-on-one with Edmonton Elks president Chris Morris, who revealed his team could, and I stress could, because you got to get there, be profitable in the not-too-distant future. What were your takeaways from the conversation?
Well, I mean, the full conversation is up on our YouTube page and our podcast feed for anybody who wants to listen to it in full. I'd recommend it. It was a long, wide-ranging interview. But the biggest takeaway I had was just how transparent Chris Morris was. He was very happy to talk about details that a lot of CFL teams typically don't offer, right? When you especially talk to the privately owned CFL teams, generally they don't answer any of these types of questions. They don't want to discuss their financial situation. And I think they really like just kind of having this blanket understanding that's not really provable or disprovable, that, oh, 7 out of 9 teams lose money. 7 out of 9 teams lose money, which is to say, okay, the 2 publicly owned teams that have the fullest buildings, they make money, everyone else doesn't. Because obviously, if you're a privately owned team, you are very, very, there's every incentive for the players, the people who you're paying and negotiating against when CBA time comes up, for them to think, oh, we're just a bunch of poor folks who are losing our shirts owning this team. Please don't ask for more, right? And the same is true for the operations cap with your coaches and your player personnel folks and your scouts and all that. So
that needs to stop in our league, to be honest. Like, enough of that junk. If you want to be progressive and moving forward, just be real. Like, look at the NFL and some of these other leagues. I'm not saying the CFL is going to be the NFL, but Hodge, it just strikes a nerve with me, because let's be transparent and grow the league together.
Well, and I've talked to people who are, you know, dubious of some of the, like, I don't think anyone's doubting that the Toronto Argonauts lose money. Like, you just have to look at BMO Field, and yeah, I fully buy that they're losing money and probably a not inconsiderate amount of money. But we also know that the league is sharing revenue more than it has at any point in the last several decades. That includes Grey Cup revenue, which is extremely substantial, because so much of Grey Cup is, you know, okay, let's get money from the province. Let's sell millions of dollars worth of tickets and beer and merch and all those things. And then, oh yeah, a bunch of these parties that are thrown, it costs $50 to get in. We're going to, yeah, we have to hire security, but like, a lot of the people who work here are volunteers, right? And so you're not paying labor, and then you're making hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars coming in the door through events that aren't even tied directly to the game. They're just parties leading up to the event. So, and look, I don't want to come in with a bias that teams are profitable or not profitable. I just want to come in with an open mind. And so I commend Chris Morris, and I'll also credit JC. He was the one who asked Danny Maciocia, I thought, some fantastic questions about the Montreal Alouettes and their stated goal of profitability. Maciocia was forthcoming, saying they're very close to breaking even and could become profitable in the future. And Chris Morris even went as far as to give me a number as to how many people they need in the building to be profitable in Edmonton. This is a quote. 20,000 would be close. At 20,000, depending on what your partnership is, depending on your merchandise, what your other streams of revenue are, you could be close. 22,000 to 25,000 is where you're like, okay, now we're making money. Now we're going to be a profitable organization, close quote. So last year on paper, I went and looked, the official attendance number for the Elks was just shy of 20,000. Now that's an official number. We cannot prove or disprove official numbers, but I will say using the eyeball test and speaking with whether it's Andrew Hoskins, who covers the Elks locally for us during the season, or others, I think a lot of people are very at least doubtful of the fact that there were that many people in the building consistently, though we don't know how many people potentially bought tickets and didn't use them, or how many people showed up without paying for tickets and got in for free. We don't know. But I think it's very newsworthy that Chris Morris is saying they only need 20,000 people consistently in order to be close to being profitable. And just 22,000 to 25,000 would make them profitable. End quote. We're now making money. We're going to be a profitable organization, close quote. Like, that is not an unrealistic number. The Edmonton Elks once had consistently 35 to 40,000 people at every game. And they've got 30,000 in just their lower bowl at Commonwealth Stadium. Now, the pandemic hit and the name change hit and the team lost 22 home games in a row and they changed presidents and they made some bad hires on the football side of the corporate. So, like, I get why all this happened and nobody can wave a magic wand and change that. But what we can change is how the Elks are going to operate and grow moving forward. I think they've set a really nice foundation. And it's interesting to know in Edmonton that this number exists, because I think though every team is a little different, every team situation is a little bit different, you can use this as a bit of a barometer as to whether or not other teams are making money, especially because most teams in 2025 did have over 20,000 consistently in the building. The BC Lions had over 25,000, which was the high number that Chris Morris said you need to be profitable. Obviously, we'll get the official numbers from 2025 from Saskatchewan and Winnipeg, who are both over that number. But I thought this was really good from Chris Morris. It was a pleasure to chat with him. And again, I'd encourage everybody to read the full article for all of the details and listen to the interview, because he was great.
Yeah, fantastic interview with Morris Hodge. And I think there's legitimate reasons for optimism in Edmonton because of how he's handling the business side, how entrenched he is in the community. It's interesting to me that you bring up that 20,000 fans in the stands number to reach profitability, because as you noted in the article, at one point, just a decade ago, the season ticket numbers were over 20,000, right? When the Elks were at their peak, the green and gold were still drawing tons of fans, and they were making money because, as a publicly owned team, we were able to see their financials and they were profitable, right? That dropped dramatically over the last decade because of a lot of the dynamics that you spoke about, some of it outside the Elks' control, some of it well within their control. And I think the biggest thing here is now the football has to catch up to everything else, because unless you win, it's not going to matter. And it's not going to happen overnight. If the Elks put up a 10-win season next year, I don't think that cures all their ills and solves the problem. But I think if you can consistently prove that you're in the mix, competing for Grey Cups, winning games, when you're not losing 22 straight at home, people are willing to support football in the city of Edmonton. It's been proven for decades. This is not a situation like Toronto, where we're talking about a team that is struggling and has always struggled. That has not been the case in Edmonton. This can be salvaged, but you have to prove it on the field. And that's the most important thing, because when I think back to the last time the Combine was in Edmonton, what was that, 3 years ago? Dunk, you sat down with Victor Cui for a very similar type of conversation. And I think we came away from that one with optimism as well in terms of some of his innovative new ideas. And I believe within a year of that conversation, he was out, or maybe a year and a half. I'm forgetting the exact time.
I think it was less than a year, actually.
But like it was fairly quick after that sit down that everything fell apart, and clearly that progress was not made despite all of the positive things that he said. So Morris has to back up the talk, and the football team has to deliver on the field.
That's why I stressed could be profitable, because talking about it and reaching that goal are two completely different things. But full credit to Chris Morris for his transparency. Same credit should go to Danny Maciocia for talking about the Alouettes' financial situation and even his involvement in not just the football operations, but it seems like Maciocia is heavily involved in essentially every area of that franchise. And him saying they're very close is definitely a positive for the league. So let's see if the Elks can get there. I think we should be careful about saying that, okay, well, if Chris Morris said, you know, around 20,000 fans makes us close to breaking even, that's the same in every market in the Canadian Football League, because every market is unique, as you guys know, different cities, different provinces, different taxes, what have you, different fan bases, all the rest.
Different stadium deals.
Yes, exactly. So I think we should be careful about extrapolating that to all the 9 CFL franchises, but it does give a great view into Edmonton. And he did say there are some qualifiers. I think that's important there in terms of your partnerships and the sponsors that you have for the organization. So that's a real key. But as a fan, if I was a fan of the green and gold, I'm sitting there saying, okay, there is hope for this franchise in the short term and the long term that we can be profitable. Like, that's something that I can jump onto. And what I'm most talking about is the transparency. You can understand it. Now your fans feel even more a part of the franchise. So I would challenge the other franchises in the Canadian Football League to match Chris Morris's level of transparency, because I think it can only benefit you. I think this is so great, and credit to you, Hodge, for sitting down with Chris Morris and digging in with the questions to get these types of answers. I think Morris is that type of guy as well, but to me, that only draws the fans closer when they realize how close their team is, and in this case, we're talking about Edmonton, to potentially being profitable, even though Edmonton went through all of the stuff that we talked about recently. So it's well worth a listen, well worth a read. Great job, Mr. Hodge.
Well, I appreciate it. And the timeline, I should note as well, that was roughly laid out by Morris, because he got hired just after the 2024 season. So he considered 2025 year one, and he kind of said, okay, year 3-4, which would be 2027 and 2028. He's like, we could be close to potentially, you know, based on how a few things go, be profitable or at least be breaking even. But he said year 5, he's like, I'm confident that, and I don't want to speak for Chris Morris. You can check the quotes, but by year 5, I think he's very hopeful that they'll be profitable, which means 2029, which, yeah, it's still 3 years away. But if the Edmonton Elks were to go 13-5 this season and host a playoff game, I wouldn't be surprised if the Elks had 25,000 people in the building. I mean, it's still a long way to go to get back to 40,000 if they could ever do that, like they had 15 years ago, but
let's
they don't
just
have
see
to
it
get
happen.
There.
I don't think we should be making predictions, okay? A lot of hard work is going to go into it.
I'm not making predictions.
You just said you think you could see them having 25,000. Like, there's a long way to go here. Let's not get it twisted.
I said based on if they were 13-5, and I'm not going to make a prediction about if we can get back to 40,000. I'm saying it wouldn't surprise me if they got to the type of numbers Chris Morris was envisioning. And I think what you're saying, Dunk, is well taken. Like, I don't want to present this as, oh, if the X and Y for Elks, then that applies to everybody. But there are some ways that teams all have similar budgets. For instance, they all get the same amount of television revenue that's split, I've been led to believe, 10 even ways, 9 to the teams, 1 to the league office. And they all have very similar expenses, right? The ops are capped and the players are capped. So theoretically, you know, there's lots of other expenses, there's lots of other revenue streams, but some of these figures, at least from team to team, are the same. And I've got the attendance numbers in front of me. I'll round these to the nearest 1,000. but we mentioned the Elks at 19,000. League-wide, this past season, it was an average of 23,000. BC was 27, Calgary 22, Edmonton 19, Saskatchewan 28, Winnipeg 32, Hamilton 23, Toronto 15, Ottawa 18, Montreal 21. So again, I'm not saying that, oh, a low number means they're losing money, a high number means they're making money. But for instance, again, we've seen it repeated time and time again in the media space. Oh, 7 out of 9 teams lose money. It's like, well, Chris Morris thinks that Edmonton can make money between 22,000 and 25,000. Well, Hamilton, which I think has a much better stadium deal than a lot of teams, like BC is a terrible stadium deal. Is that correct, JC?
Yeah, that's my understanding. You see the conversation that's going on with the Vancouver Whitecaps right now in terms of the MLS essentially threatening to move the franchise because they don't believe there's any path to them being a revenue generator with their current stadium deal with BC Place, which is a provincial crown corporation. The Lions are on what I believe to be an almost identical stadium deal to that. And so that is a limiting factor to their ability to make a profit from things like, concession revenue and ticket sales. All of those things play into the conversation when you talk about a team becoming profitable. And I won't profess to know how that situation compares to other stadiums around the league, but there are different dynamics at play here. And I don't think Commonwealth's situation necessarily applies to everywhere else.
Well, and I'm highlighting Hamilton because the Tiger Cats have fantastic corporate partnerships. They've got a ton of them. They have people buying into that ownership group that also has other franchises in under its flag. And they had 23,000 people on average at games last season. So I'm not saying they are profitable. I'm not saying they aren't profitable. What I am saying is I don't want to blindly say 7 out of 9 teams lose money. Because I'm skeptical. I'm not saying I know one way or the other, but I'm skeptical.
That's fair.
On that Hamilton
I think
point,
when you're looking at Hamilton, though, what's the maximum capacity for the stadium? Like, their stadium was built in a very specific way with premium seating and the corporate sponsorships and all the rest.
I'd have to check. Give me a second.
Also in the Hamilton situation, and Dunk, you could probably fact check me on this. Am I incorrect in remembering that the ownership group for the Ticats, the Hamilton Sports Group, also controls the stadium? I believe that's part of their portfolio, is it not?
That part I would need to double check. Forge FC is involved, the CPL soccer team for sure.
Well, because they're all under the same umbrella, if I remember correctly. If you're controlling your own stadium, that helps with that revenue aspect.
It does, and that's why I think, again, we should be careful just looking at attendance numbers and projecting whether or not a team might be profitable.
I think it's fair to ask questions, though.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's not fair to ask questions. I'm just saying I don't think we can project that to every other market because as JC just laid out in BC, their stadium deal is much different. Like, Hodge, you know this in Winnipeg, that team store is open year-round. Same in Saskatchewan. Like, there are how many full-time workers that just even work in the Rider store in Regina? Like, the franchise in each city is different. The amount of people that work for those franchises outside of football operations is vastly different. So I just don't want it to come off like we're saying, okay, you get 20,000 fans and you have a CFL team, you might be profitable.
Yeah, and we're not saying that. But Danny Machocha at 21,000 thinks the Alouettes are very close. And the number, depending on how you want to interpret what Chris said, between 20 and 25 gets the Elks to be where they need to be. And if a bunch of other teams, like I don't have a hard time, again, believing the Argonauts are losing money. I don't have a hard time believing the Red Blacks are losing money, given where their attendance figures are. But I do think that the more data we have to work with, the better, rather than, and I'm saying this for the media, not just fans and the public, rather than just blindly repeating the phrase, well, 7 out of 9 teams lose money, because we don't know that that's a fact. That's just a thing that people are saying. Those are two different things.
Agreed. So we need to go out and do the work and have similar interviews if the access is granted with other team presidents, and hopefully they might be as transparent. So that's on us to continue getting legitimate data that we believe in. But I think for this specific example, we should focus on Edmonton and look at that team and what Chris Morris is saying, because I do think we can take what he has said about the possible, and again, I stress possible, profitability at face value.
One of the things Chris said, which made me laugh, was, you know, he was talking about all the positives and he said, but at the end of the day, if we lose a bunch of games to start the year again, it'll be like perfume on a pig, right? And so starting strong is very key for the Elks in 2026. On a completely related note, the Edmonton Elks have brought in former Grey Cup champion head coach Rick Campbell as a coaching analyst. What does that mean for the Elks and head coach Mark Killam entering his second year as a bench boss in the CFL?
I think it means the pressure is on. No matter how you slice it, I'm sure Mark Killam can benefit from having Rick Campbell and his knowledge on the staff. But to me, this is a clear message that if you falter, there's somebody in-house who can replace you. Somebody who has deep ties to this organization through his father, Hugh Campbell, who is the most legendary coach and executive in the history of the Edmonton franchise, right? Rick Campbell is a guy who has proven it, who has done it. Mark Killam is a guy who is trying to establish himself. And the reality is, when you're in the financial situation that we just laid out and you are trying desperately to get back to profitability by getting fans in the building and convincing them that you're going to be competitive, there is not a lot of leeway in terms of a second year learning curve, right? That's the message to me here with this hire. It was interesting to me in the article that we published today on Friday about Rick Campbell speaking about the hiring process for this job, that it was Ed Hervey who reached out to him and not Mark Killam first about the possibility of this job. Obviously, those two have a relationship from their time together in BC. And it's notable that the GM is reaching out and making potential coaching hiring decisions here instead of the head coach, as is typical in these situations. I think back to what played out in Hamilton a couple of years ago when Scott Milanovic was brought onto the staff with Orlando Steinauer as head coach. At that point, he was the offensive coordinator, but we talked at the time about how that put pressure on Steinauer to deliver and get the team over the hump. Otherwise, Milanovic could be the heir apparent. And within a year, that's what played out. Steinauer stepped back into the president's role, and Milanovic was made the head coach. When you look at the Killam situation, obviously he's not going to be moved into a president's role, but I think there's a similar dynamic in play in terms of hedging bets if he proves that he's not the guy this season.
I can't understand, if you're Edmonton, why you would want to do this. You ended the season on a relative high note last year. Your head coach is going in just his second year as a bench boss, as Hodge noted, and you want to put pressure, extreme pressure, not on just him, but create a weird dynamic around your football team. When Ed Hervey has talked about, since he got hired there as a GM by Chris Morris, them having a family atmosphere and being great in the community and all those things. And it seems like the team's on the upswing. They have a great free agency. Credit to Hervey and his football operations staff for going out and getting some difference makers. We've noted how good their Canadian depth is, but you bring Rick Campbell like literally into the building. You could have him waiting in the wings if possible. But JC, you said it. That note is very key, that Campbell said that Ed Hervey reached out to him. And I'll leave it at that. But I just cannot understand why you would want to make that decision and just make everybody in the organization who's on Team Killam, let's say, grip the club, grip the bat even tighter, and feel that pressure. It makes no sense to me, considering the end of the season they had last year, which included beating the Saskatchewan Roughriders, who eventually went on to win the Grey Cup, and people like us talking about the Elks potentially being a dangerous team if they could have made the playoffs. I don't understand it, to be quite honest. And I think it's quite funny, actually, that it seemed like, just based on the quotes, Rick Campbell even has a difficult time explaining what a coaching analyst does. Well, if you're a coaching analyst, you're assessing the coaching staff. And then he even names Mark Killam. Like, this to me is just unfathomable, considering the Elks situation, considering Mark Killam being from that area, him talking about getting back into the green and gold. He played his university football for the Alberta Golden Bears. I just don't understand it. I get that you want to get off to a great start to the season, but to have Campbell actually in the building, I don't think does much good for the franchise. I'm happy to be shown otherwise, and I think perhaps Killam and his messaging and all the talent that they have there can get over this. It's like an own goal in soccer. Like, they just created a speed bump for themselves. They created a hurdle. I just can't believe it, to be honest.
We should credit Morley Scott of 880 Ched, who actually did this interview. We wrote off the quotes, but it was an 880 Ched interview done during Combine. And shout out, Morley. We had a nice chat during the Combine at the bubble at Foot Field. But the quote from Campbell I thought was telling. And in his first answer, the question was basically, what does a coaching analyst do? I'll read you the quote. Campbell says, I'm going to be doing things like advanced scouting of opponents, which is a very necessary thing in football. I'm going to do game management reports, a lot of things that a head coach would do in anticipation for a game. So just being an extra guy on hand. Mark Killam knows exactly what he's doing. That's not the point of this. It's just trying to assist the coaching staff in any way I can and hopefully bring the knowledge that I have being in the CFL for a long time, close quote. So I thought telling.
What
I thought it was
quote.
Like I appreciate, I'd probably do the same thing if I was Rick Campbell, right? But when, before you're even asked a question about how this relates to Mark Campbell, the fact that you feel like you need to say, oh, but no, this isn't about me becoming the head coach.
Mark,
right?
Killam,
like Mark did a
Mark
great
Campbell.
Job.
Mark Killam.
What did I say?
Mark Campbell. You meld them together.
My bad. Well, they look so much
alike. That's what the Elks are trying to do.
They're trying to have Mark Campbell. No, the fact that Rick Campbell felt the need to, in his very first answer, insist that this is not about Mark Killam not being a good head coach, and that Mark Killam's doing great, I thought was maybe, I don't know. On the one hand, it's good messaging, right? You want to back your head coach. On the other hand, like, it almost just feeds the speculation for me. And I will also say, I thought that Rick Campbell was going to get this job last year. Rick Campbell was the head coach hired by Ed Hervey in BC. Like, Ed Hervey's literally hired Rick Campbell to be his head coach before, right? This has happened. And with everything that Chris Morris has said, with Ed Hervey has said, we want people who live in Edmonton. We want people with history in Edmonton. We want people to be all Edmonton. And for the record, Campbell did indicate that he still lives in Vancouver, right? Dating from his time with the BC Lions. He does not live in Edmonton, but he's about as dyed-in-the-wool Edmonton as you can get. He coached there for a decade over two different stints. And obviously, as JC touched on, he is the son of arguably the most beloved figure in franchise history, other than like what maybe Jackie Parker. And that's a pretty darn short list of where Hugh Campbell fits even now in 2026 in that franchise history. So I'm not saying this is a bad move. I think if you can hire a smart person and fit them onto your staff, which is hard to do with the operations cap and its limitations, you do it. But I do think that it raises questions. And I'll also say this, given how Campbell has gotten very positive reviews from all the people I've spoken with on and off the record, given the way the team finished, like, are you really going to fire him if you start 0-4 or 0-5 or 1-6? Like, are you really, like you've just sold to the people of Edmonton time and time and time, like, this time is going to be different. This time is going to be different. We're going to be good. We're going to win games. Are you really going to fire another coach if they have a bad start? Like that,
That's the talk in the league, Hodge, and that's exactly why I'm making my point that I think this is a bad decision.
And I'm not doubting that. I'm questioning if the Elks were to do that, if that would be the right decision, even if the team starts slowly.
Why else are you bringing Campbell into the building as a coaching analyst? That might be the most made-up job I've heard in coaching yet.
And that quote that you lay out there, Hodge, in fairness, if you really boil it down, the first section of it, what does a coaching analyst do? What does it do? Rick Campbell essentially says he does the things that a head coach does just for the head coach, right? He's like, I'm just going to do all of Mark Killam's responsibilities. Well, sounds like you're being groomed to be the head coach there, Rick. Like,
well, he's not finalizing the game day roster. He's not giving the rah-rah speech. He's not calling the timeouts. Like, he's not doing all the head coaching duties, but your point is well taken.
He's preparing to potentially take over as the head coach. Let's just call it what it is. It's like we're not talking about the elephant in the room, but it's right beside us. Like, imagine being in those meeting rooms as a player.
Right.
You got to be dumb not to put two and two together. That's why I just don't understand it. Sorry, guys.
Let me rephrase my point. If you as the Elks are going, okay, we're not even willing to give two full years for Mark or any other coach, if we're not willing to give our hire two full years to have success, then you shouldn't be hiring that person. Like, that would be my counter argument. It's like, if you're making a head coaching hire, you should be prepared to live and die with that person for at least two full seasons. If it's a complete disaster, I mean, Jeff Reinbold got two full seasons as a head coach, for goodness sake, right? Great assistant, terrible head coach. And you can't argue otherwise. So
I mean, if it's bad, though, a coach shouldn't just get two seasons, blanket statement, but I know where you're going with this.
Fair enough. If Rick Campbell can genuinely help, great. And maybe the Elks will be great this season. We've been talking about them a lot and their improvement and all the positives, and yes. But by the same token, your point is well taken.
The reality is, I feel like Ed Hervey is talking out of two sides of his mouth at times, because every time he speaks to the media about the previous regime, he talks about the player turnover and people weren't in town and everybody was coming in and out of the building and there was no consistency. And then when he comes out and actually does things, well, is he going to be committed to his head coach for multiple years? Like, that's consistency. That's somebody who's supposed to put down roots in your city and in your organization, somebody who's already done that, who's tied to the culture in Edmonton. And even when it comes to player movement, some of his, you know, more brutally honest takes in terms of certain positions being expendable and certain players being expendable, that to me flies in the face of the message that they talk about in terms of wanting to retain everybody and everyone lives in Edmonton all the time, and go back to the days before there was even free agency, when everyone was just a local player. Like, those do not coexist in my mind. Now, frankly, if you're going to cut people, cut people. Like, be honest about that. But I don't think you can speak out of two sides of your mouth.
He was pretty honest about Martez Ivy.
Well, that's the thing. So on one hand, you're saying, yeah, we're going to stop player turnover. And then on the other hand, you're honest about Martez Ivy and you say Niles Morgan's expendable.
But they're trying to get better, too. Like,
I agree with that.
You don't stick with the player if you think somebody else is better.
To me, the first part, the talk about less player turnover and all that, that's just lip service, right? That doesn't actually get you better. And I'm not sure that they are towing that line. And whatever happens with this Rick Campbell thing, if it does result in Mark Killam getting moved on from and Campbell becoming the head coach, to me, it's just another indication that that professed desire to have consistency isn't necessarily true. They want it on their own terms, right? And that's fine. Just say that because people can smell it when it stinks.
Dude, they can see the elephant from miles away. That's why it's just unbelievable. It's worth noting, Mark Killam signed a 3-year contract when he was hired as head coach. So he is contractually tied to the team through the 2027 CFL season. And perhaps we should take the straight down the road approach and say, maybe this could work out for the Edmonton Elks. Perhaps Rick Campbell coming in could benefit this team and they could go on to that 13-5 record that Hodge predicted and have 25,000 fans in the building. Perhaps it could all work.
Predicted is a big word.
That's what you said on the record, bro.
I said, if they go 13-5, that is not the same as saying, I think they're going to go 13-5.
Tell all the internet trolls that.
Well, if we're going to abide by the logic of internet trolls, I don't even know what we're doing.
You're going to hear about it.
Sure, that's fine.
I'm just messing with you. All in good faith. I think we've broken this down very fairly. And let's see what happens. The Calgary Stampede unveiled a 20-year master plan for their grounds, including the possibility, I stress again, the possibility of an expanded multi-sport stadium that could, I stress could, host the Stampeders. Head coach and general manager Dave Dickinson acknowledged his team needs a new stadium in the next 5 to 7 years. I mean, I think they've needed a new stadium for at least 5 to 7 years, if not longer. I don't think the next 5 or 7, but I get it. He's playing the political game. Could that be a viable solution to replace McMahon Stadium, which is hosting the Grey Cup in 2026?
My favorite part of the article that we wrote off of Dave Dickinson's quote here was multiple, and I swear it was multiple people who replied with some version of, wait, in the next 5 to 7 years, are you sure you didn't misquote him? And he said in the past 5 to 7 years, like 3 or 4 different people were in my mentions making that joke. And it made me laugh every time. Look,
So wait, you read the internet trolls.
Well, I don't think that internet trolls and pithy jokes are the same thing. I like the pithy jokes. This, however, to me, like it's newsworthy that there's some talk of a stadium in Calgary, but like, and it's possible that I'm wrong. Maybe in behind closed doors in Calgary or the province of Alberta, there's people who are really putting together nuts and bolts and budgets and trying to figure out how to get this done. From my perspective as a non-Calgary infrastructure insider, all I've seen is a group of people with the vested interest of having a stadium built who aren't going to help build it themselves have said, hey, this would be a nice spot for the new stadium. In which case, what is there to talk about here? Like, yeah, there's lots of places that would be nice for a new stadium. That doesn't mean it's going to get built. It needs to get built, and McMahon should have been replaced during the, you know, what it, in hindsight is almost like a golden age of CFL infrastructure when you had Mosaic Stadium and Princess Auto Stadium and, you know, Hamilton Stadium all opening in relatively quick succession and all replacing buildings that were as old and dumpy as McMahon was 10 years ago. And one consistent theme when you listen to Jay McNeil, the team's president, and Dave Dickinson brought up, is the challenge with McMahon is it's like expensive just to keep it open, right? Like it's expensive to do the concrete repairs and the maintenance needed to just keep it being where it is now, which is a not good stadium. So if you're paying money to polish a turd, for lack of a better term, why not just build a new building, right? But I mean, the province of Alberta has also essentially paid for two brand new hockey stadiums or hockey arenas in the last 10 odd years. The Flames building is not opening, I don't think, till the fall of 2027. The Oilers have a beautiful brand new building that opened just a few years ago. So I get that infrastructure spending is tough and you got to make things work. And the government in Alberta doesn't like spending money on literally anything. So like, I get all of that. But
jump
right
in
now,
with the University of Calgary. To me, that's the most direct route to a stadium. I know there'd be logistics to work through, and I know I'm cutting you off here, Hodge, but honestly, why not do it? The Dinos are after it, fundraising for it.
Yeah, but if you're the Dinos, you don't want to be in a 35,000 seat building. That's the problem that we have.
It doesn't need to be 35,000 seats.
But
the Dinos are trying
25?
to put a campus on stadium.
The campus or the by the, you asked about the Hamilton Stadium attendance. It's publicly listed as just over 23,000.
So Dino's proposal, for the record, is between 3,500 and 7,000.
Yeah, which is a
so
great
you need to more than double the max.
I'm just saying, I think that's a faster way to a stadium. Like, I believe Dickinson even referenced, like, he doesn't even know if he's going to be around in 20 years.
Right.
In terms of the Calgary Stampede project. Like, what is your most direct route to a potentially viable stadium? And I think it's possibly working with the University of Calgary, which is something that they already do closely now with McMahon Stadium. I'm not saying that that's a legitimate option at the moment, but if the Dinos are interested in having this stadium on campus, why would you not at least have the conversation to say, hey, would you be interested in potentially a 25,000 seat stadium or a stadium that is expandable perhaps for Stampeders games and other big events that they might be able to draw in there? I think at least you got to have the conversation. That's all I'm saying.
Let's be clear about the financials here as well, though, because the Dinos have raised money, $21 million towards that new stadium project, which is much smaller. I have the Wikipedia page, for whatever it's worth, for Hamilton Stadium up because I was confirming the ownership situation there. And in 2013, the cost to build that stadium was $145 million. Presumably, those costs have gone up, I would expect, significantly since then to build a CFL caliber stadium. So the fact that the Dinos have some money already in place, to me, it's not nearly enough. That might be enough money to build a nice little.
I'm not saying it's enough. I'm just saying have the conversation.
I just don't think. And by the way, credit to the Dinos for raising this money. I think it's awesome.
Yes.
And I think it's great that they want a new building and they're being proactive. That's great. I don't think that shared buildings between U Sports and CFL works great. Like, the Manitoba Bisons have a loyal fan base that shows up to every game, and the game day production is awesome at Princess Auto Stadium with all the colors and the logos and the graphics. It's great. The problem is the building is never, ever, 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 ever going to be more than 15% full, and that makes it impossible.
So how else
are
the Stampeders
going to
get a new stadium?
By going
future.
To the government, just like the Oilers did and the Flames did, and saying build us
that's
a new
totally
thing.
Different conversation. It's hockey.
To me, the Stampede project is the best route because I think there is a broader justification there for government spending. Now, there's no timelines in here other than this is what we want to do in the next 20 years. So you could speed that up and make it in the next 5, or it might not be for 20. But the reality is they want to renovate GMC Stadium, where they currently host the Stampede events. They're going to put in more premium seating, better stands in that facility, one way or another. That's their plan. And what's been floating is we could potentially put in a little extra if we get the support to make this a multi-sport venue for both the Stampeders primarily, but also potentially soccer teams, where we have a retractable turf that comes out over the ground that they use for the horse events. And we can put major sporting events in that venue. All of that is hypothetical at that stage. I'm not trying to dismiss that. And I don't know Calgary or the Stampede ground well enough to say whether that's a good spot for the Stampeders to play or not. But there is going
anywhere
to
is
be
better
something.
Than McMahon Stadium, bro.
Absolutely. But there's going to be something at the Stampede ground. So if there's already money going in that direction, I think it's a lot easier for the Stampeders to say, hey, can we get on board here? Let's do something that's good for us, that's good for local soccer teams, that's good for the Calgary Stampede, which I don't want to be an economic expert, but I would imagine is a massive moneymaker for the city of Calgary because it's an internationally recognized event. So if the government's going to be spending money there and they have other justifications for doing it, to me, that is the path of least resistance. But I think you need to do more than what Calgary Sports and Entertainment did when that proposal was floated, which was saying, yeah, if they build it, we're probably on board. I think you need to push it now. And if you're not pushing it, then you are doing a disservice to your CFL franchise.
If you're not having conversations with people who want to build a stadium, I get it small, I think you're doing your own franchise a disservice. I'm not saying that that would be the ideal situation. I just think you at least should be having the conversation. I do agree with both of you. Calgary Stampede Project would be likely the most ideal, and probably that's how you could get city and provincial funds. But if the Dinos are trying to get a stadium built, why not just at least have the convo? Hodge, you good?
Yep. And I think we're actually, again, unless there's information we don't have, which is entirely possible, but I believe the three of us are as close to getting a new stadium built as anybody is in the actual city of Calgary. So regardless, the people whose job it is to make this happen need to start making this happen. McMahon was done 15 years ago.
Well, I will end with one last point, and I don't know who said this on Twitter or X or whatever you want to call it, but I thought it was an appropriate comment that we are going to have a Grey Cup in a stadium this year that is not good enough for the Calgary Dinos. That is not a great situation to be in.
That's actually amazing.
That might have been Matt McGill's, I'm pretty sure. It
might have been. I don't have it in front of me. So credit to whoever said it.
Let's keep it moving. We're on a time crunch here, JC. Let's roll.
Okay, speeding along.
If you want to get to all your topics, you want to get to all your topics or not? You want to do your random neck lister or not? Let's go.
3downnation.com ranked all 9 CFL quarterback rooms heading into training camp, taking into account both the quality of starters and the depth. Who did you rank at the top, and which room do you have the most concern about?
Hamilton and Winnipeg. Hodge, what say you?
I had Hamilton at the top. I had Winnipeg at the bottom.
I had Toronto at the top of mine, even though there is some skepticism about Chad Kelly. I think they're the deepest, and Winnipeg was at my bottom. I think they're in real trouble.
Do you think Chad Kelly heard that?
Well, I don't know. I don't think he listens to me. He certainly doesn't talk to me.
Look, the Winnipeg Blue Bombers are going to be in a better situation if and when Taylor Elgersma signs, and we'll talk about that.
Hodge, you brought him up.
We'll talk about that later in the show. But right now, you can only judge what's there. The Hamilton Tiger Cats have a quarterback who for the last 2 seasons has been elite in Bo Levi Mitchell. They've got a dynamic player in Trey Ford, who I think is going to improve dramatically under the coaching of Scott Milanovich, who's been as good as anyone in the last 10, 15, 20 years of developing CFL quarterbacks. I think that the Toronto Argonauts have great depth. And I think that the BC Lions, we've got them at 4. The only reason is they've got the best one. Other than that, they've got nobody, which, by the way, is a big theme in the West Division. If you look at BC, you look at Calgary, you look at Saskatchewan, you look at Winnipeg, if all of their starters go down week one, then we can start planning the West Final at Commonwealth. The 13-5 Elks, you heard it here first, because they're the only team with Taylor Powell who I think has a great backup plan in the West. Four of five teams right now, in my opinion, in the West, do not have sufficient depth, and that is why so many of those teams are represented in the bottom few teams here. The Ottawa Redblacks finished seventh. That's a little low for me, because I do think they've got two proven guys, though I don't think Drew Brown or Jake Mayer right now would be considered high-level starters, so that's why they're there. But I think that our ranking is good, and I'm glad that it generated some conversation.
These rankings are tricky, though, because not just looking at the top guy, and there are questions about Chad Kelly coming back from his broken leg. He hasn't played football by the time he potentially takes a snap in the Argos' first game in 580 days. I'm not saying that he can't regain the MOP form that his head coach Mike Miller believes he can, but when you're out of football for that long, we have seen various performance levels from different athletes coming back from a gruesome injury. And not only that, but going back to the place where that injury happened for your first game, I think is a mental hurdle to get over. So for me, I was trying to look at the depth of the quarterback rooms, and mine was based strictly on 2026. I know you guys had a little different formula for how you did your rankings, but I was looking at Hamilton. I think there's some great depth there. Jake Dolagala has started games in this league. Of course, Trey Ford's the backup to Bull Levi Mitchell. I think Montreal looks really good with Dustin Crum in there, who has a similar playing style to Davis Alexander. Crum is not yet, or has not yet shown, he can play to the level of a Davis Alexander. But I think if Alexander did happen to get hurt and had to miss some time, that you can plug Crum in there. And Jason Moss seems to be a big fan. Edmonton was my personal number three because of that depth. Cody Fajardo has shown he can lead a franchise to a Grey Cup when nobody was picking them in 2023. And Taylor Powell seems to me to have some upside. And then I had Toronto at four, which I think easily could be higher, but I got that question about Chad Kelly and his broken leg. Nick Arbuckle had a great season last year while Kelly was out. Ottawa's at five for me because I think, as Hodge said, there's two good quarterbacks there, but there's some potential to be realized if they would move up those rankings. BC for me was at six, and that was a hard one because Nathan Rourke, credit to John Hodge, called this leading into the season in 2025, is the best player in the league. Let's just call it what it is. But there's a massive drop-off if he gets hurt. Then I had Saskatchewan at seven, Calgary at eight, and Winnipeg at nine. I think those are relatively self-explanatory.
To me, the team that's a little too high is Montreal. I love Davis Alexander. I think he has sky-high potential, but the injury issues last year, that's still a concern for me.
It was just one issue, though.
It is one issue.
It was one issue, and he's 100%.
One issue.
Well, it was multiple issues with the same body part.
Yes.
Fair enough. That's still a concern. I'm not sold on Dustin Crum as an elite caliber backup. He can win you games, but I'm not sure he's in the Jake Mayer category. And then I think,
looking around the league, if a backup can win you games right now, that's an elite backup to me. That's
Crum with Jason Moss, though, I think could be different. And
potentially.
Dustin Crum is still relatively young in his CFL career. And I spoke to him in an interview that will come out prior to training camp, and he told me, he admitted that he was playing backyard football in that first year. He wasn't expected to ever go out there and start. So I think his progression, getting with not only Moss, but Anthony Calvillo, and being in that quarterback room with Davis Alexander can be a great benefit. I think there's a lot of upside in Crum. I get your questions about him, JC. I just want to get that out, that this guy has the awareness at least to say, hey, yeah, I was playing backyard football in that season where the majority of people saw me play.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I just have a little bit more questions about Montreal than where they ended up slotting in at the number three spot. And I was higher on Edmonton. I agree with you. I think there's upside with Taylor Powell. And I think Cody Fajardo doesn't have a particularly high ceiling, but his floor is very consistent.
Hod, do you want to run through yours real quick?
Sure. We're all talking about transparency. Here's my numbers from 1 through 9. Hamilton, Toronto, Montreal, BC, Edmonton, Ottawa, Saskatchewan, Calgary, and Winnipeg. That was my ranking.
So for the people that don't know, these rankings were compiled just by the three of us. And then that's how we got to...
And we did them blindly. Like, we didn't know what the other people were doing. So then we put them together and that was the average. So I think Justin and myself were almost identical, which makes sense because with our shirts off, we look identical. But...
Probably a little difference there, Hodge. I'm going to be honest with you.
Hodge, Boston College offensive lineman Kevin Klein has been added to the 2026 CFL draft, as you exclusively reported for 3downnation.com. How could he change the way the picks play out on Tuesday, April 28th?
He could change a lot. I mean, Klein was born in Boca Raton, Florida, but he qualified for Canadian citizenship through his mother. And his father actually played three seasons along the defensive line with the Ottawa Rough Riders. So this is a guy with CFL bloodlines, Canadian bloodlines. And we've seen just as recently as 2 years ago with Joel DeBlanco out of Cincinnati being the first overall pick to the Edmonton Elks in 2024, these late additions can be premium players. Now, this year's draft class is different. Every draft class is at least a little bit different. The O-line group is really deep, and Klein is an offensive lineman. He's 6'6", 315 pounds. He was the full-time starter at left tackle for Boston College in 2025, a six-year veteran of that program. Funnily enough, he played alongside a couple of Canadians there, one being Logan Taylor, who's likely to be a late-round NFL draft pick this year, and Kyle Hergel, former first-round pick of the Riders, who's now with the Chicago Bears. When you talk to CFL scouts, they will tell you that Klein might get an undrafted free agent contract down south, but he might just get minicamp invitations, which would mean he's available to CFL teams right away. That makes me think he's going to be a first-round pick, possibly even the first overall pick. Though I will say, in keeping up, because I first heard of Klein back in February, he apparently got his Canadian citizenship a couple of months ago and was informing CFL teams as recently as his pro day last month that he was not considering the CFL, was just going to be focused on the NFL. Well, suddenly on Thursday, that changed when he finally completed the paperwork and got into the draft. Typically, when players who are American can get Canadian citizenship, they get the passport, boom, they file their CFL draft paperwork immediately. There was a significant gap here with Klein, and I think that has given some teams some trepidation going, okay, this guy has a master's degree. He's a six-year college player. He's never lived in Canada, as far as I know. Is he going to be committed to the CFL if he comes up? So on the one hand, he's a starting tackle at a group of four school at the NCAA Division I level who's available potentially right away. Boom, that's a first-round pick. On the other hand, I think that that delay has given some teams pause. So I do think he's going to change the first round of the draft because barring a UDFA deal from the NFL, I think he goes round one. But this is also a year where there's lots of great offensive linemen available. So, you know, I think that it's possible if people say, oh, well, now there's five O-linemen who are worth a first-round pick. Maybe I don't have to use a first-round pick to get one because one of them is going to slip to round two, right? You never know. So it's an interesting story. He's a good addition. There's a couple of other guys who I'm following as well who might get added to the draft late, but it's a big development, and I'm curious to see how it changes things.
Yeah, Klein's a good player. I think he's, you know, a bruiser in the run game at times. He's got a big body. I think he's solid in pass protection. I don't know that he's an NFL caliber tackle, but he's certainly a guy who can compete for that type of role in the CFL. Just on my initial glimpses of film that I've seen of him, this is a guy who could very well go first overall if teams are confident that he is committed to the CFL, which is a big if. If you look back at some of these sort of pseudo Canadians, There have been a lot of success stories, the Alex Singletons of the world, but there have also been a lot of swings and misses of guys who have retired early or not panned out because they didn't feel the ties to the Canadian game and want to continue their careers in that way. It'll be up to teams to assess where Klein falls on that spectrum. The off-the-field stuff and his commitment level are just as important as the level of talent.
My favorite late addition, JC, you stole my thunder there, to a CFL draft was indeed Alex Singleton. That worked out pretty well. I'm not saying Klein is going to have a career like that, but no doubt, as you two have noted,
Alex Singleton 2.0.
That's the comp. Just said
that. That's the comp that scouts are telling me.
Fair. Just shows you how impactful these late ads can be. And as you guys noted before Hodge cut me off, which I've done to you guys a couple times, so my apologies, is that he's a good player. He's a really good player. So sometimes these late ads can legitimately shake up and affect the draft right at the top of the board, depending on obviously the NFL interest. Right. So great scoop, Hodge.
And to be clear, like, this is not a player who CFL teams did not know about prior to Thursday when the paperwork was finalized. Teams have known about him for months. The question was, is he going to finish the paperwork? So there's no new scouting here for teams to do, but I do think that there were some teams taken aback by the fact that he did complete the paperwork, because when it had been a couple of months, I think some of them are going, okay, if he's not done the paperwork now, he's not coming to our league. All of a sudden he is. So it's, he's not a new evaluation for teams, but he is a new player to assess just in terms of how does he fit into the class and where is he going to get taken? Because obviously, even if you're a team who's not taking him, him going to another team changes the draft. Anyways, let's get on to JC's random nag lister.
I'll hit it real quick. I like my small school guys, so I'm going to highlight receiver and kick returner Jeremy Ombogo from North Park University in Division III. He's on the Calgary Stampeders neg list. This is a guy I think could compete as a returner in the CFL. He's small guy, 5'7", 162 pounds, but was a track star, four-time All-American, set 16 different school and regional records, ran a 4.45 at his recent pro day at Northwestern, and has been dangerous as a receiver at times. It's tough to judge Division III guys compared to players who play against tougher competition, but he pulls away like nobody else. He's got that second gear at the small school level. I'd be really intrigued to see him come up to training camp and compete for a returner position.
Hodge's heritage moment on this day in 2009, Frank Morris passed away at the age of 85. He played 14 seasons with the Argonauts and in Edmonton at guard and defensive tackle. The Toronto native won 6 Grey Cups as a player, then 7 during his stint as Edmonton's director of player development, a position he held from 1973 to 1988. He was inducted into the Canadian Football Hall of Fame in 1983.
Let's go to the three-minute drill. Former CFL and NFL quarterback Chris Streveler has announced his retirement from professional football. How will you remember his career?
Ultra athletic, ultra tough. Teammates loved him as much as anybody could. I'm going to miss watching Chris Streveler run around like a maniac, tough, and obviously a great guy to deal with as a member of the media. I'm going to miss watching Chris Streveler play. The BC Lions have announced their coaching staff for the 2026 season, bringing back former defensive coordinator Mark Washington as linebackers coach. Is that a smart move?
I think it is. I think he'll be a value add to the organization. Interestingly, Mark Washington, former BC Lions defensive coordinator, defensive back coach Ryan Phillips, former BC Lions defensive coordinator, and defensive coordinator Mike Benavides, former BC Lions head coach. The whole gang's back together. Canadian quarterback Taylor Elgersma has been forced to sit out the Birmingham Stallions' first 2 games in the 2026 UFL season due to ongoing work visa issues. How long do you expect him to wait prior to considering other options?
I think as long as there's a chance that he could get it, Elgersma's going to wait. But if it doesn't pan out, stay tuned, CFL fans. Toronto Argonauts general manager Michael Pinball Clemens revealed former NFL offensive lineman and Canadian Dakota Shepley cold called the team asking for a contract? Is that the best phone call a CFL team could possibly receive?
It's pretty much the best phone call you could receive. Like an elite player who's Canadian at a position of need calling, asking for a deal. Yeah, that's about the best call you can get. The Ottawa Redblacks have said the team will listen to offers for the first overall pick in the 2026 CFL draft. Do you anticipate them making a move?
At this stage, I don't. I do think if you look at the history of the CFL draft and first overall picks, it would be smart for more teams to move out of that position. But it takes two to tango, and with a pretty talented draft class, I don't think there's an incentive for a team to move up and grab one guy that's head and shoulders above the rest. The Saskatchewan Roughriders revealed that right tackle Jamarcus Hardrick played a key role in the signing of former NFL running back Darrell Henderson Jr. Does that prove how small the football world really is?
It does, but there's a caveat here because both these players are from Batesville, Mississippi. Population about 7,500. So that's the connection that helped the Riders get Henderson Jr. to Riderville. MLSE President Keith Pelley has said he is, quote, optimistic, close quote, about the Argos for the 2026 season, even though the team's playing 12 road games. And he believes new head coach Mike Miller is, quote, spectacular, close quote. How meaningful is that endorsement from the MLSE boss?
You know, this was a kind of a throwaway line at his Maple Leafs press conference. I think the biggest thing worth taking away here is that the Toronto Argonauts stole time away in a press conference from the Maple Leafs, which happens the reverse all the time. Very seldom does it happen the other way around. Canadian Football Hall of Famer Tom Brown passed away in March at the age of 89. Where does he rank in BC Lions history?
In my opinion, Tom Brown is not just one of the most underrated players in BC Lions history, but in CFL and potentially pro football history. This is a guy who finished second in Heisman Trophy voting at the University of Minnesota as a defensive tackle at the time, came up here, was absolutely dominant until his career was struck short by a neck injury. Had he played longer, we'd be talking about him as one of the all-time GOATs. Hamilton Tiger Cats head coach Scott Milanovic talked to former NFL head coach Cliff Kingsbury for advice on how to best utilize a dual threat QB such as Trey Ford. Is there anyone more qualified to give advice than the person who coached Kyler Murray?
There probably is, but this quote stuck out to me from Milanovic. One of his lines was, I'm not going to tell you who was in relation to, but he said, one, two, make a play. That's it. You're reading 1-2. If that's not open, take off. Do your thing. And I replied, I think I know who that was in relation to. And JC probably just named that guy. We're making some guesses here, but I think it's a fair assumption. The Saskatchewan Roughriders won the inaugural Ted Gavaya Football Operations Award, while Corey Mace was named the CFL Coach of the Year in March 2026 for 2025. Make it make sense. Were these the obvious choices?
Yes, I think these were the obvious choices. We don't know the voting totals for the Ted Gavaya, but for the Coach of the Year, Corey Mace won in a landslide. Toronto Argonauts quarterback Chad Kelly said he feels, quote, really good, close quote, ahead of training camp, but declined to answer Three Down Nation's questions confirming whether his leg is 100%. Do you think he'll be ready to go after not playing last season?
I do think he'll be ready to go. I got that sense, but let's just be frank, Chad. Doesn't matter if you answer the questions or not, we're going to keep asking them here at 3M Nation. The Calgary Stampeders have signed return man Tyreek McAllister following his release from the UFL. Is that a good move?
I think that could definitely help out the Calgary Stampeders. There's some people been talking about some of these teams signing. People have been cut by UFL teams, but let's reiterate it, fellas, the Canadian game is different. McAllister has been really good up here, which earned him an NFL shot. I think he still has the potential, I stress potential, to be a difference maker in the three-down game. Kicker Brett Lawther has said he is not planning to retire after his release from the Saskatchewan Roughriders. Do you think he'll find a new home in the CFL?
You know what? There's not a lot of kickers out there. And so if an injury happens or somebody starts the year badly, it wouldn't shock me. But I also understand why he's a free agent right now, considering the type of season he had in 2025. The Montreal Alouettes have signed veteran linebacker Micah Awe, who led the CFL in tackles last season. Does he make the Owls better?
I think he's a tremendous depth piece, and with a young linebacker like Jeffrey Kanteng-Arku seemingly penciled in as the starter there, it's nice to have somebody with experience to guide him along. He's not going to start for this team, certainly not right away, but a good insurance policy to have around. The Saskatchewan Roughriders have signed long snapper Aaron Crawford. Will he be a capable replacement for Jorgen Hughes?
Yes, if indeed Hughes does retire. University of Saskatchewan quarterback Anton Amandrud has revealed his cancer is in remission following 6 rounds of chemotherapy, and he intends to play for the Huskies in 2026. Is that the best news you've heard all week, potentially all year? I would say yes. Hodge and JC, what say you?
Absolutely. We are not supposed to cheer for anybody or any teams here at Three Down Nation, but I think we're all cheering for Anton Amandrud to get back to 100% and get back out on that field where he belongs in 2026. Best wishes to him and all of the friends and family in his support system on behalf of Three Down Nation. For Justin Dunk, JC Abbott, I'm John Hodge. Thanks for joining us. And boys, we're only a few weeks away from training camp. Get ready, get real. It's going to be great.